Welcome to February. That brings the celebration of Black History Month and the achievements of Black Americans. It's also a month to think about heart health, both physically, it's American Heart Month, and romantically, hello Valentine's Day. One thing about February we're not necessarily celebrating right now, however, is the six more weeks of winter that punk Satani Phil just forecasted this week. The National Weather Service issued some serious cold weather advisories for this week, so stay warm out there. Coming up on this episode of The Eagle, we'll go over the top headlines.
Yes, Jess, it's happened. I put a musical donkey story on the front page of the Times Union.
We'll hear about a 28-year-old cold case that police in East Greenbush say they've solved.
At the time of Violet Filkin's death, he was an 18-year-old recent graduate of Columbia High School.
Thousands of crows chose the city of Troy to roost late last year.
They took over the city, and crows do what crows do.
And part of the city became a noisy, poop-drenched battleground. And we'll get another little taste of our brand new Times Union podcast about the disappearance of Jahleek Rainwalker.
The first thing I remember about Jay was his eyes, and I had never seen, I live in a rural small town in Vermont, and I had never seen a boy that looked like him before.
This is The Eagle, a Times Union podcast, a look inside our newsroom. I'm Jessica Marshall.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome to The Eagle. I'm Jessica Marshall. Okay, now let's discuss what appeared in the Times Union and on timesunion.com this week. All right, we are here again with Times Union Editor-in-Chief Casey Seiler. Let's go over the top headlines. We'll start with Governor Kathy Hochul's 2024 budget proposal, which she released this week. What can you tell us about the highlights?
Well, it is a $227 billion proposal that over the course of the next 2 months, and hopefully not longer than that, will be negotiated with legislative leaders. The big ticket item, I think it's fair to say, is plans and incentives to double the growth of housing in New York over the next decade, investing $1 billion in mental health services, and proposed measures to address violent crime through both what might be called hard and soft techniques, the harder techniques involving changes to bail laws that will probably receive a somewhat chilly reception in the legislature. But of course, everything is a negotiation. And Jess, I point out that not just our Capitol Bureau, but sort of beat staffers from throughout the newsroom put together just an outstanding kind of topic by topic explainer of the major elements of the governor's proposal, filled in our print edition, filled a whole page, just really good work. And we do this not to give the governor's plan publicity, but to explain, you know, what's coming in terms of, for example, funding for SUNY schools, which of course is a big deal around here, as well as to give people the context for what the negotiation is going to be like over the course of the next 2 months before the deadline to pass the plan before the new fiscal year begins on April 1st.
Yes, it's a very comprehensive breakdown. You can also see it in the Capital Confidential section at timesunion.com. Go check that out. Let's go from the current governor to the former governor now, who will have his legal bills paid by the state, is what we learned this week. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, the Attorney General's office on Wednesday formally notified the state Supreme Court justice who has been sitting on this dispute with former Governor Andrew Cuomo that yes, his private counsel will be paid for by taxpayers as he and a former top aide attempt to defend themselves in a lawsuit that was brought by a state police investigator who was a member of the governor's protective detail, who alleges that the governor sexually harassed her. Inappropriate touching, a kiss, inappropriate comments, and so on. Of course, you know, this was covered in the Attorney General's investigation of these allegations against the governor. The governor has apologized in part for some of these actions, but he denies that he sexually harassed her. It is, of course, an interesting dispute because the Attorney General's office, of course, oversaw the investigation that resulted in the release of that report. Now, the Attorney General's office and state taxpayers are going to have to pick up his private legal bill. Of course, it would be wildly conflicted for the AG's office to defend the former governor, considering the circumstances here. But the argument is that in past cases, public officials have had their defense picked up in cases that involve sexual harassment, despite the fact that obviously sexually harassing a public employee is certainly not within the scope of anybody's duties, public or private.
We covered the governor's downfall in 2021 and all of the aftermath very extensively, both on Times Union, in the Times Union, and on this podcast. So if you're looking for a little background, I would definitely go back and check previous episodes of this podcast. All right. So this week, also, the feds busted a fairly large marijuana trafficking ring that involves some local folks. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, two dozen people scooped up on both coasts and charged with taking part in a California to New York pot trafficking ring. One of the people scooped up is Rosemary Coles, who is 70 years old and a member of the Troy City School Board. She was arrested along with her daughter, who lives out in California. The allegation is that they were shipping pot into New York. This, of course, I should say Ms. Coles has denied it. She said that she has done nothing wrong, that the allegations against her involve nothing more than her driving her daughter to the bank. This is happening, of course, as both of the states involved have legalized recreational marijuana, but of course, it still remains a narcotic that is banned from interstate commerce. So it's one of those strange cases. Of course, it will be moving through the court system, but Ms. Coles, meanwhile, remains on the school board despite being charged with conspiracy to manufacture and possess with intent to sell more than 1,000 kilograms of marijuana, as well as money laundering and money laundering conspiracy charges over the course of 6 years, according to the indictment.
All right. Moving on to a story that was quite popular this week among our readers. The Forts Ferry Farm, which is in right now in Albany County and Colony, has announced that it's closing its farm stand, moving to Columbia County, all over its battles with regulators in the town of Colony. Tell us more about that story.
Yeah, Forts Ferry Farm, which is, I guess you would say, an artisanal farm with a farm stand, and they had wood-fired pizza and, you know, music and movie nights and that type of thing, has just basically said enough in its rather contentious at times dealings with Town and Colony officials. They've said, look, we're just going to shut down retail operations. We'll sell our wares at the Troy Farmers Market and further down in the Hudson Valley. But they say that everything from getting a water line put in to signage outside their, you know, where basically their farm hits the road, has just turned into an expensive, drawn out process of kind of getting pecked to death by ducks. Now, Jess, I will note that the owners of Forts Ferry Farm includes Emma Hurst, who is the daughter of our publisher, George Hurst. George Hurst owns the land. The farm leases it from our publisher. This is, of course, not a situation that editors relish being placed in, covering, you know, a dispute involving the boss. But Steve Barnes, who is as good as they come when it comes to covering pretty much anything, especially anything involving food, you know, was sent to report this story with the edict, cover it as if the owners of Fort's Ferry Farm were an elderly couple who you've never heard of before. And he did an outstanding job of that, spoke not only to the owners of the farm, but also to other people around Colony who expressed concern and upset over similar dealings with the town of Colony. The town says, of course, that it is, handling the farm appropriately. And but yeah, it was a story that we're talking now less than 24 hours after it went online, continues to draw eyeballs.
Yes, a lot of eyeballs on that story. All right, one last story before I let you go. It's one that I couldn't resist talking about because it involves animals. And I know we've had many conversations about the animals of the Capital Region. But in this case, we are talking about a donkey, a special donkey up in Saratoga County. What can you tell us about this guy?
Yes, Jess, it's happened. I put a musical donkey story on the front page of the Times Union. I don't know if we've crossed some kind of Rubicon, but it was a delightful story by Wendy Livertour about a donkey named Gus, who was in the ways that donkeys can sometimes be, and I don't mean to profile or stereotype, but was apparently previously a very obstreperous animal that was directing its energies into a lot of negative behaviors. I can't believe I'm saying this. But turned to music, and not only music, but also sport, playing basketball, that type of thing. I will say, I've seen the video. I'm sure you're about to play a clip of it. Look, Gus is no Charlie Watts by any stretch of the imagination, but it's remarkable that he's even trying.
That is such a great story. Yes, head over to timesunion.com to see that video and read the story. It is delightful. All right, Casey, thank you so much for joining us. We will check back in with you next week.
Thanks, Jess.
As always, you can learn more about all of the topics and issues we discuss on this podcast at timesunion.com. All right, let's turn our attention now to one of the region's older cold cases. You've probably heard me say this line before. We do have a few older cold cases that we tend to talk about on this podcast. And as with others, we urge you to listen with care because some of the topics may be disturbing. In January, there was a break in a 28-year-old case from East Greenbush. In mid-August of 1994, 81-year-old Wilhelmina Filkins was found dead in the living room of her apartment. The cause was multiple blows to the head. Her car was found parked in an unusual spot, and a number of her belongings had been dumped on a nearby rural road. Until now, there had been no suspects in the murder. East Greenbush police called a press conference 28 and a half years later.
Today, on behalf of all law enforcement involved, I am pleased to announce we have identified the suspect in the 1994 murder of 81-year-old Wilhelmina Violet Filkins as one Jeremiah James Guyette.
So they have a suspect, but it's complicated.
Investigation revealed that Jeremiah was found deceased in his garage from an apparent gunshot wound to the head.
Rapid Response Team reporter Rose Schneider covered the story for us. I connected with her to get more information.
The catch was he was already dead.
Ah, that's a big catch.
So the suspect is Jeremiah J. Guyette. He would have been 46 today. At the time of Violet Filkins' death, he was an 18-year-old recent graduate of Columbia High School. He had moved to the area from Minnesota very recently. He spent only his senior year at Columbia to live with his father and, according to police, lived right around the corner of this apartment complex in East Greenbush. from Violet Filkins.
According to police, Jeremiah J. Guyette was questioned after the murder in 1994, but only as a neighbor and a possible witness, not as a suspect or a person of interest. Police had nothing tying him to the crime scene.
After 1994, he left the area. You know, it was pretty much shortly after he graduated. He went down to Red Hook. He enlisted in the military, was down in Florida, was discharged, came back up to Red Hook, and then eventually found his way to Rosendale.
Police say they got a tip in April of 2019 from an ex-girlfriend of Guyette's. She said Guyette had been at her house 10 years earlier and had said some very strange things. Here's East Greenbush Police Detective Sergeant Michael Guadagnino at the press conference earlier this month.
The acquaintance shared that approximately in August of 2009, Jeremiah had started crying at their home and made statements such as, "That poor old woman, I robbed her, I hit her and I just left her there. This can't be true, I'm sure she's fine."
That's when police started looking into Jeremiah Guyette as a potential suspect. In October of 2019, Guadagnino and another investigator went down to Rosendale to try to speak to him.
And he, you know, says he wants to talk to his lawyer or have a lawyer there and, you know, just refuses to talk to them. And the next day, he has reportedly died by a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
But how exactly did police connect Jeremiah Guyette to the murder of Violet Filkins? According to police, it was a thumbprint on Filkins' coffee table. A thumbprint that had been lifted almost 30 years ago, but never had a match until now.
It's just interesting to me how it was first self-acquired. It's very gruesome, just post-mortem. But they also had to basically take all her belongings out of storage that they had in evidence for this 28-year-old case in order to check for fingerprints. And I believe it was like his, I don't know if they established that there was any others, but they very much focused on it was his left thumbprint on this on the corner of a coffee table.
But there's nothing else to do from here, right? Because the suspect is dead and there's closure, right?
Yeah, beyond like taking that evidence, and taking any other, you know, accounts from relatives or past acquaintances of him, it is pretty much, you know, they've named him as a suspect, but yeah, it does seem like that's kind of about it for this case. It kind of just ends here.
Rose reached out to Guyette's family for comment, but did not hear back. Violet Filkins was unmarried and had no children, but she had 8 siblings. Her niece, Carol Filkins, was at the press conference.
I'm sure my aunt would never have envisioned anything like this happening. She was a very simple woman, lived quietly, and would never have envisioned what occurred, but we're all very thankful that it has now been resolved.
After the break, at the end of last year, the city of Troy became a battleground of sorts. It all started when the crows came home to roost. Also, we'll hear another segment from our brand new Times Union podcast, Rainwalker, The Lost Boy.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. I'm Jessica Marshall. Well, we're headed out to Troy for this next segment, for which the popular saying, "the chickens have come home to roost," comes immediately to mind. Except, instead of chickens, in this case, it's crows. The crows of Troy. Crimes Union reporter Katie Kiesling has been following this avian saga in the Collar City. I caught up with her to learn more.
One of the things that I learned, you know, back in the day that I found very interesting was that a group of crows is called a murder, which is something that you cite in your article. Was that something new that you learned, or had you always known that?
That, for whatever reason, was a fact that I've always known. I don't know why.
I wonder, I have to go back and see what the etymology of that is. But when you see murder in your article, you're talking about this giant group of crows, thousands and thousands of crows that descended upon Troy this past year and became something of a phenomenon. So let's start there. What's the deal with the crows in Troy?
Yeah, so the crows, through my reporting I learned, they usually would roost on Starbuck Island, which has since been transformed into a series of luxury apartments. Right before they take off and migrate for the season, they will roost and they will find a place to settle down. And for some reason, this past winter, 10,500 of them decided that Troy was the city to roost in. They took over the city, and crows do what crows do. So they
pooped everywhere, right?
A lot, and it ended up, you know, becoming a neighborhood nuisance that the city responded to. And their response was to have the community email the special account, report any flocks that they saw that were settling in certain locations, and the city then collaborated with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to come up with a dispersal plan to encourage the crows to roost elsewhere.
However, that would be seemingly normal and unremarkable. I mean, I've heard lots of stories, and I've even reported stories myself on efforts to get rid of, you know, birds that were posing a nuisance to communities. But in this case, the community kind of rallied around the crows. Can you tell me about how that came about?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating to me. But this one artist, his name's Oliver Holacek. He is the founder and owner of Primo Botanica, which is this craft chocolate shop. Saw the initial notice that the city put out the beginning of December and was like, this is a joke. I can't believe that the city is going to be investing so much, you know, time and effort and money into these crows. Yeah, they're, you know, crapping everywhere. They're cawing, but how much harm are they really causing? And he kind of just shared the city notice and found out that a lot of other people in the community thought it was ridiculous too, and saw that, oh, this isn't just me. I'm not the only one that thinks this is a ridiculous response. And he ran with it. He made We Support the Crows graphic. He made this chocolate bar that was splattered with white chocolate for Primo. He went to Hoffman's car wash and got a bunch of car wash vouchers and set up scavenger hunts and giveaways. And other artists too started to jump on the crow trend. They started to see that this was a cultural phenomena in Troy, and that the community was really, you know, taking pride of this strange little sort of mascot of the city, really into this sort of crow culture.
I guess it's not surprising too that the car wash industry was behind the pro crow movement. I suspect yeah. They benefit from it slightly, you know, with more cars going for washes when there's 10,500 crows just pooping all over the place.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, one of the artists I talked to, David Rialli of Life Supply, was not a fan of the crows at first. He was saying that there was one day he washed his car, parked it, ran a couple of errands, came back out and saw that he had to go and wash his car for the second time that day because it was annihilated. which he then, you know, took that kind of frustration and, you know, he was like, okay, the community is really for this, you know, pro-crow, they want crow things, they keep asking me for it, I'm going to channel my frustrations. And he actually made a sweatshirt design that the one shoulder is splattered with an embroidered like poop stain. So he found a way to creatively channel his frustrations, which I thought was really clever.
Yes, absolutely. And I do want to just quickly mention here, for those who don't know Troy, who aren't familiar with Troy, how substantial the artistic community is in Troy. Can you kind of quantify that a little bit?
Yeah, Troy is such a creative hub. It's become home to so many artists. I feel like there's a lot of experimental work happening there. You've got, you know, Troy Foundry Theater that's always playing with the structure of what theater is. And you have all of these wonderful artist-led communities that are starting to pop up that are specifically for artists, like the Fish Market. You have all of this public art that's all over Troy. So it's really become sort of a really large and important art scene within the capital region. So to me, it's like not too terribly surprising that the city really leaned into the Crows in this way, with that many creative minds just living there.
Absolutely. Now, what's happening with the Crows now? When do they fly south now, or are they still there? What's the deal?
Back in mid-December, I believe it started around the 19th of December, the city officially started its week of dispersal efforts. So they brought in wildlife biologists from the USDA, and they used lights and sound making devices, which like included recordings of crow distress calls, to encourage the roost to travel.
To move along.
And talking to a representative from the city, she said that the efforts were successful. And they were able to encourage the roost to fly along to their next location. I'm not really sure what the migratory patterns of crows are. My guess is they probably are traveling someplace that's a little bit warmer.
A little warmer, more sunny.
Yeah, but so Troy has less crows flying around everywhere right now.
Is it possible that they'll come back? I mean, they found a pretty welcoming community when they first settled here. I mean, yeah, is that a possibility?
I'm curious to see what happens. One thing that I was reading about crows is they are vengeful creatures. They'll remember names and cars. So I'm hoping that the dispersal efforts didn't inspire a grudge of almost 11,000 crows, because that would be
a giant murder of crows seeking revenge. Yeah,
revenge upon Troy.
Not ideal.
I'm curious to see if they come back, since Starbuck Island was such a regular roosting site for them. That region does seem to be sort of a home for them when it comes to the roosting season. So I'm curious to see if they come back, if the crow culture is still continuing, if people still, you know, are pro crow, or if the second time, you know, a murder of that size comes through and poops everywhere, it's less amusing.
Like maybe we're over it now.
There's also a crow fest apparently that's in the preliminary stages of organizing, that's going to be like a 3-day arts festival in November, around the time when they think the roost will return. So I'm very curious to see how this all continues to unfold.
The Times Union launched a brand new podcast this month. It's called Rainwalker, The Lost Boy. It explores the mysterious disappearance of 12-year-old Jalik Rainwalker. He vanished without a trace in 2007 from the Washington County village of Greenwich. His case was ruled a probable homicide, but no suspects were ever named. Our 7-part series delves into the life, disappearance, and 15-year search for Jalik. Here's a little bit of our 3rd episode, which dropped this week. Before we begin, a word of caution. The story we are about to tell involves situations that may be very disturbing to some listeners. So please take care as you listen. Abby Andrews was about 11 when she went to theater camp in southern Vermont. It was 2006.
There was singing, dancing, and we put on a performance, a play for all the family members and all the band and everybody that attended the camp. Every year we did some sort of musical. So a lot of singing, dancing, acting, teamwork, bonding, things like that.
Abby's 27 now. She lives in Bennington, Vermont, not too far from where the camp was, actually. It was a 3-week summer program held on the campus of the former Southern Vermont College. She remembers loving every minute of it. One year she was there, they put on a performance of Seussical the Musical. She got the starring role.
I was JoJo, the little boy, even though I'm a girl. I played a little boy, and because I was one of the lead roles, I interacted with everybody on the set.
One of the kids on set she remembers most was a member of the ensemble, a boy about her age. Abby Andrews says she was drawn to this boy. He was magnetic. Everyone called him Jay.
The first thing I remember about Jay was his eyes, and I had never seen, I mean, I live in a rural small town in Vermont, and I had never seen a boy that looked like him before. And I had a little bit of a crush on him. I won't lie. I know that sounds strange and odd, but I mean,
no.
I had crushes on a lot of little boys growing up, and he definitely was one of them, just because he was so beautiful.
Abby says she and Jay spent a lot of time together during the camp. They both attended 2 years in a row.
And what would you say, he had a lot of talent?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He loved he was very excitable. And he definitely loved the aspect of the dancing and the singing. And I mean, I think he was great at it because he had so much confidence in himself.
Abby wanted to hang out with Jay outside of camp. But Jay said he didn't have any internet, so they couldn't really keep in touch.
My parents definitely had met his parents somewhere along those lines, and it was just a hard no about ever having a relationship with Jalik outside of camp.
Was so, it his parents, or...?
I don't know. I can't speak on that. I don't know. I just think it would have been hard to have a play date with him.
The November after their second summer at theater camp, Jay, whose full name was Jalik, went missing.
So how did you find out that he went missing?
I saw it everywhere. I mean, I remember hearing it from my parents. I saw the billboard in New York. There was posters, flyers all around Bennington. Teachers were talking about it. It was everywhere.
How were you feeling when you found that out?
I was sad. I was super sad, but I was hopeful that he was going to come back. I mean, I was young. And throughout the years, I'm 27 years old now, he would be my age. I just have a really sad gut feeling that he's not coming home ever. And it's sad. It's very sad.
Abby Andrews knew Jalik Rainwalker as a confident boy who enjoyed theater. But under the surface, his life was very, very complicated, and in many ways, tragic. Rainwalker, The Lost Boy, was produced and edited by Wendy Libertor and myself, Jessica Marshall. We had help from Lauren Stanforth, Susan Mihalik, Lori Todd, Erica Smith, Tom Crocker, Jeff Shearer, and Casey Seiler. The theme song is As You Make the Bed by Amos Noah. New episodes of Rainwalker, The Lost Boy drop on Tuesday mornings. You can listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And head over to timesunion.com for timelines, photos, and more extras. All right, that's it for this week. I'm Jessica Marshall. We'll be back next week with another look inside the newsroom here at the Times Union. In the meantime, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, or head on over to timesunion.com for the latest news and features. The Eagle is a production of the Times Union. It's produced and edited by me, Jessica Marshall, with help from the Times Union digital team and the newsroom. Special thanks this week to Casey Seiler, Rose Schneider, Katie Kiesling, Will Waldron, and Jim Franco for their contributions to this episode.